Yes, and stayed with me until I was calm.
He had stayed with me through the night, even when we heard two isolated doors open, when we heard his father walk the hallways with a sobbing Simone. Sometimes he liked a final fuck before killing a girl. Better in her room than in those secret rooms, I guess.
Des stayed with me until the morning, when all the doors lifted, and the other girls filtered into the garden to cling together against the painful loss that he didn't understand, because he didn't know she was or would soon be dead.
Did he think she was just being kicked out or taken for an abortion?
My younger son can be hard to know.
Meaning you can't read his reaction to us.
He laughed and nodded, sliding down next to me in the chair.
One arm came around my shoulders, arranging my head against his chest, and for a moment, we could have been any two people cuddling together for a movie.
Except, if we had been any two people, my skin probably wouldn't have been crawling.
It certainly never crawled with Topher, or when we all piled onto Jason or Cake's couches, or any of the other boys from work. Intimacy with the gardener was as much an illusion as the wings he carved into our backs. It didn't make anything real.
He doesn't like talking about it with me.
Given that we are a sort of harem, I don't imagine most young men would be comfortable discussing this with their fathers. You might ask your parents for tips on how to approach someone or what to do for a first date, but the sex thing is usually verboten even when there isn't the question of willingness.
And it was another reminder that we weren't just any two people because all he did was laugh and turn my head to kiss me. It occurred to me that I could go to his private kitchen en suite and pick up a knife to drive through his heart. I could have killed him then and there, but what stopped me was the thought that Avery would inherit the garden.
Avery was all excitement when I first introduced him to the garden. He talked about it whenever we were alone. Perhaps a father doesn't need to know that many details about his son. But I can't see that Desmond has done anything more than look around.
Does that disappoint you? I asked neutrally.
It puzzles me.
His hand traveled up my arm to the back of my neck, where he tugged at the tie of my dress. The black silk pieces came loose in his fingers, and he watched them slither down my collarbones to my waist, leaving my breasts bare. He lightly traced one nipple as he spoke.
He's a healthy young man surrounded by beautiful women, and I know he isn't a virgin, yet he doesn't avail himself of the opportunities.
Perhaps he's still adjusting.
Perhaps. Or perhaps variety isn't what appeals to him.
He lifted me slightly in the chair so he could shift under me, giving himself better access to my breasts and pushing my dress over my hips to my thighs.
He looks for you when he comes, even if he doesn't find you.
Apparently I'm a very direct sort of person, I said dryly, and he chuckled.
Yes, I can see why he would put his questions to you. What would you do if he came to you as I do?
I assumed that, as with you and Avery, we were to do whatever was asked of us. Was that incorrect?
So you would let him touch you?
He bent his head to my breast, lips moving against sensitive skin.
You would let him take his pleasure with you?
Desmond wasn't his father, but he was his father's son. Unless you tell me otherwise, I do what's asked of me. He groaned and tugged the dress completely off, dropping it to pool in a black puddle by the chair, and as his mouth and hands turned my body traitor, not a word was said except for my name. Over and over, harsh cries against the silence. There are some qualities, some incorporate things that have a double life. There is a twofold silence, sea and shore, body and soul. One dwells in lonely places. He took me again and again that night in the chair, on the carpet, in the king-sized bed, and I recited everything I could remember, even drink recipes. But long before the morning came, I'd run out of words, and felt the poison seep through the cracks into my soul.
I'd gotten used to the sick feeling that came with letting the gardener fuck me. But I'd never get used to the nauseating pain that came of letting him believe he loved me. When he finally escorted me back to my room, he sat on the edge of my narrow bed and settled the blanket around me, stroking the hair back from my face and giving me a lingering kiss.
"I hope Desmond comes to realize what an extraordinary young woman you are,"
he whispered against my lips.
"You could be so good for him."
After he left, I got out of bed and stood in my shower, scrubbing at my skin until it was raw because I just wanted to pretend that I could slough away the feeling of his touch. Bliss found me there, and with unexpected tact, she didn't say a word. She helped me rinse off the last of the soap and conditioner and turned off the water, toweling my hair as I dried off the rest of me. And when my hair was brushed free of tangles and bound back in a neat braid, we curled together under the blankets. For the first time, I understood why she'd think about jumping. For the first time, those extra years didn't seem worth the negligible possibility of escape. For the first time in a year and a half, I felt every drag of the needle across my skin as my prison was inked into my body. If I'd never been much for hope, neither had I been much for despair, but I could feel it choking me with every memory. I took a deep breath, listening to the echo of Desmond's voice in the cave, and let that remind me to keep breathing so that even Bliss, who saw me through things the others never even imagined I felt, wouldn't see just how fucking scared I was. In terror she spoke, letting sink her wings till they trailed in the dust. In agony sobbed, letting sink her plumes till they trailed in the dust. Till they sorrowfully trailed in the dust. But my wings couldn't move, and I couldn't fly. And I couldn't even cry. All that was left to me was the terror and the agony and the sorrow.
Victor leaves the room without a word. A moment later, Yvonne steps into the hall from the observation room, handing him two bottles of water. "Ramirez called with an update," she reports. "The girls in more delicate condition are stabilizing. They still want to talk to Maya before answering too many questions. Senator Kingsley is starting to lean on Ramirez to get to Maya." "Shit," he scrubs at his cheek. "Can Ramirez keep her leashed in the hospital?" "For a little while, she's negotiating between the senator and her daughter. She figures she can get a few hours out of that with everything else going on." "All right, thanks. Let Edison know when he gets back." "Will do." Politicians are like child services, he thinks. Ultimately useful, but a pain in the ass all the way there. He returns to the interrogation room and hands Inara one of the bottles. She accepts it with a nod, unscrewing the cap with her teeth rather than her tender hands. Half the bottle disappears before she puts it down, her eyes closed. One finger traces patterns on the metal surface of the table as she gathers herself for the next question. He watches the motion, his gut clenching when he realizes that what he thought were nonsense symbols proved to be butterfly wings, traced again and again into the metal like a reminder of what brought her here. "I'm running out of time to protect you," he says finally. She just looks at him. "Powerful people want to know what happened. They're not going to have my patience with you, Inara, and I have been very patient." "I know." "You need to stop dancing around this. Tell me what I need to know."
For a while, the gardener just had to continue being baffled by his younger son. Desmond came to the garden regularly, but he didn't touch anyone past a hand to help them up. And he brought his textbooks. During the days, I stayed with the newest arrival, an exquisite creature of Japanese descent. During the nights, Danelle stayed with the sleeping girl, and I sat up on the cliff, clinging to the illusion of space. Desmond frequently joined me there, and the first few times we sat in silence, each of us lost to our own reading. It had been a long time since I could sit with a male and not feel actively threatened, Not safe, precisely, but not threatened. We talked about his studies sometimes. Never about the garden. Never his father. I hated him, I think, for refusing to put the pieces together, but I didn't show it. The gardener was never going to let us go, and Avery was too dangerous to try to influence. I wasn't sure Desmond was hope, but he was the closest thing to it that I could see. I wanted to live, and I wanted the other girls to live, and for the first time I wanted that myth of the escaped butterfly to be true. I wanted to believe I could get out without ending up in glass or the riverbank. Then, one night Desmond brought his violin. The gardener had told me his son was a musician, and I'd seen the way his fingers silently played chords against books, against rocks or knees or any available surface when he was thinking. It was like he translated his thoughts into music so they could make sense. I was lying stomach down on the rock with my book and an apple in front of me, keeping an eye on three of the girls down in the main garden. They were neck-deep in our small pond, splashing at each other as best they could, and I knew the sensors had to have alerted the gardener that someone was in the water, but all they had to do was play long enough for him to get comfortable and move on to something else. He wasn't present in the garden that night. He'd mentioned something about a charity function with his wife when I came to escort the new girl back to her room after the first tattoo session, but I didn't doubt he had a way to watch us if he wanted to. Eleni and Isra had been there 3 and 4 years, respectively, generally past the point of foolishness. But Adara had arrived only 2 months or so before me. She mostly held up well, but every now and then she sank into severe bouts of depression that were nearly crippling. They were clinically based, and without her meds, I was surprised they weren't more frequent. But we tried to make sure she wasn't left alone during these episodes. She was mostly through the latest of them, but her mood still teetered. Desmond walked up the path, his case in hand, and stopped beside the rock. "Hi." "Hello," I replied. Normal was a variable thing in the garden. I eyed the case in his hand. Would asking him to play for me flatter his ego, or would it make him feel like I owed him a favor? I was skilled at reading the gardener and Avery. Desmond was more difficult. Unlike his father and brother, he didn't know what he wanted. I was good at escaping people, not manipulating them. This was new ground. "Play for me?" I asked eventually.
"You wouldn't mind? I have a proficiency tomorrow and didn't want to wake up Mother. I was going to practice outside, but,
He pointed up. I didn't look. I could hear the rain against the glass. I missed the feeling of rain. There was nearly always music playing in the apartment. Catherine liked classical, but Whitney liked Swedish rap, and Noemi liked bluegrass, whereas Amber liked country, and in the end we had the most eclectic listening experience imaginable. Here, some of the girls had radios or players in their rooms, but for most of us, music was a rare thing anymore. I closed the book and sat up as Desmond rosined his bow and stretched his fingers. It was fascinating to watch all the little rituals that went into warming up, but when he finally set the bow to the strings to play for real, I realized why his father called him a musician. It was more than just playing. Though I was no expert, he seemed technically skilled, but he could make the notes weep or laugh across the strings. He infused each piece with emotion. Down in the pond, the trio stopped splashing and just floated so they could hear. I closed my eyes and let the music wrap around me. Sometimes when Catherine and I were sitting out on the fire escape or the roof at 3 or 4 in the morning after work, a guy from the next building over would come out onto his roof to practice the violin. He'd fumble his fingering, and his bow work wasn't always to tempo, but sitting in the semi-darkness that was as close to true night as the city could get, it was like the violin was his lover. He never seemed to realize he had an audience. Everything in him focused on the instrument and the sounds they made between them. It was pretty much the only thing Catherine and I routinely did together. Even if we had the night off, we made sure we were awake to go outside and listen to that boy play. Desmond was better. He segued smoothly from song to song, and when he eventually let the bow swing down to his side, the last notes hovered expectantly.
"I don't think you'll have a problem passing your proficiency," I whispered.
"Thanks."
He checked over the instrument, cradling it gently, and when he was satisfied all was as it should be, he put it away in the velvet-lined case.
"When I was younger, I used to dream about being a professional musician."
"Used to?"
"My father took me to New York and arranged for me to spend a few days with a professional violinist to see what it would be like. I hated it. It all felt, well, soulless, I guess. Like if I actually did that for a living, I'd grow to hate music. When I told my father I'd rather do something that still let me love music, he said he was proud of me."
"He seems frequently proud of you," I murmured, and he gave me a queer look.
"He talks to you about me?"
"A little."
"You're his son. He loves you."
"Yes, but..."
"But?"
"But it doesn't strike you a little weird that he talks about his son to his captives?"
I decided not to tell him the entirety of what his father had said about him.
"More weird than him having captives at all?"
"True."
And here he was, finally able to call us captives, and unable to try anything to change that fact. The stream that connected the waterfall and the pond was barely 3 feet deep, but Eleni managed to swim all the way up to the rocks before standing.
"Maya, we're going in now. Do you need anything?"
"Not that I can think of, thanks."
Desmond shook his head.
"Sometimes you seem like a house mother."
"What a twisted little sorority."
"Do you hate me?"
"What, for being your father's son?"
"I'm starting to realize just how much," he said quietly.
He sat down next to me on the rock, draping his arms over his bent knees.
"One of the girls in my Freud and Jung class has a butterfly tattoo on her shoulder. It's ugly and badly drawn, one of those butterfly-type fairies with a face that looks like a melted doll. But she was wearing a tube dress, and I saw it, and all I could think of for the rest of class was your wings and how beautiful they are. They're horrible, but they're beautiful, too."
"That's pretty much how we look at it," I replied neutrally, curious to see where he was going with this.
"I doubt the sight of your wings gets you off."
"Oh. Yes, definitely his father's son. But unlike his father, ashamed of that fact."
"In one of my other classes, we were talking about hoarders, and I thought of my father's story about his father's butterfly collection, but then, of course, I thought about my father's version of that, and suddenly I was thinking about you again, and how you can be more dignified in nothing but ink and scars than most people can manage fully clothed. For weeks now, I've been having these dreams, and I wake up sweating and hard, and I don't know if they're nightmares or not."
He shoved his hair back from his face, hooking that hand behind his neck.
"I don't want to believe I'm the type of person who could do this."
"Maybe you're not." I shrugged at his sideways look. "Going along with it is complicated, but it doesn't mean you'd ever do it yourself."
"It's still going along with it."
"Right and wrong doesn't mean there's an easy choice."
"Why don't you hate me?"
I'd been thinking about that a lot the past few weeks, and still wasn't sure I'd found the answer.
"Maybe you're as trapped here as we are," I said slowly.
"Except I did hate him a bit. As much as, but in a different way than his father and brother." He turned that over for a while. In a flash of lightning, I tried to make out the emotions racing across his face. He had his father's eyes, but he was much more self-aware than the gardener would ever be. The gardener clung to his delusions. Desmond eventually confronted the hard truths, or at least the beginnings of them. He didn't know what to do with them, but he didn't try to make them less than they were.
"Why don't you try to escape?"
"Because girls before me did."
"Escaped?"
"Tried." He winced. There is only one door that leads out of this space, and it is locked and coded at all times. You have to punch in your code for both entry and exit. When maintenance comes in, the rooms become soundproof. We could scream and pound all we wanted to, and no one would ever hear us. We could stay out here when the walls come down for maintenance, but someone tried that about 10 years ago, and nothing happened except that she disappeared. And reappeared in glass and resin. But Desmond still hadn't seen those butterflies. He seemed to forget what his father had said about keeping us after we die. I'm not sure if your father hires incurious people or if he made it seem unexceptional, but no one came to the rescue. When it comes right down to it, though, we're afraid.
Of freedom?
Of what happens if we almost get there. I looked up at the night beyond the glass panes. Let's face it, he could kill all of us pretty quickly if he ever felt the need to. And if one of us made the attempt and failed, what's to say he wouldn't punish all of us for it? Or, at least, the one who made the attempt and me, because he thinks they tell me everything. How would I not know of such a plan?
I'm sorry.
What an asinine thing to say under the circumstances. I shook my head. I'm just sorry you ever came here. Another sideways look, somewhere between hurt and amused.
Completely sorry?
He asked after a minute. I studied his face in the moonlight. Twice he'd helped me through panic attacks, even if he only knew about one. He was fragile in a way his father and brother weren't. Someone who wanted to be good, do good, and just didn't know how. No, I said eventually. Not completely. Not if I could figure out some way to lead him to usefulness.
You're a very complicated person.
And you're a complication. He laughed and held his hand out between us, palm up, and I didn't hesitate to take it, lacing our fingers together. I leaned into him, resting my head on his shoulder, and found a comfortable silence between us. He reminded me of Topher a bit, if more complex, and just for a little while I wanted to pretend this boy wasn't his father's son, that he was my friend. I fell asleep that way, and when morning sunlight struck my eyes, I slowly sat up to find that we'd curled together through the night, his hand on my hip and his other arm cushioning my cheek from the stone. The new girl wouldn't be awake for a few hours yet, but Desmond had classes, and at some point a violin proficiency he'd pass without even trying. Hesitantly, I reached out and stroked a comma of dark hair back from his forehead. He stirred and unconsciously followed the gesture, and I couldn't help but smile. Wake up.
No, he mumbled,
and grabbed my hand to shield his eyes. You have classes.
Skip 'em.
You have a proficiency.
I'm proficient.
You have finals next week. He sighed, but it turned into a face-splitting yawn, and he grudgingly sat up to rub the sleep from his eyes.
You're bossy, but nice to wake up to.
I looked away because I wasn't sure what was showing on my face. His fingertips, lightly calloused from the strings, touched my chin and brought my face back to his, and the only thing there was a soft smile. He leaned forward, then caught himself and started to pull back. I closed the distance between us, his lips soft against mine. The light touch on my chin moved back until his hand could cut my cheek, and he deepened the kiss until my head was swimming. It had been so long since I'd actually kissed someone, rather than just allow them to force a kiss on me. The gardener thought his son could love me, and I thought he might be right. I also thought love would prove a different motivation for the son than for the father. I hoped. When Desmond moved away, he pressed a kiss against my cheek.
Can I come see you after classes?
I nodded, even as I silently acknowledged that my life had reached an entirely new level of fucked up.
And the gardener was happy about this?
Actually, he was. I mean, I'm sure there was a certain degree of self-interest in it,
After all, if Desmond was emotionally attached to one or more of us, he was unlikely to risk anything happening to us. That had to be part of it, but I think most of it was that he genuinely enjoyed seeing his son happy. Victor sighs. Just when I think this story can't get more twisted. It can always get more twisted. She smiles as she says it, but he knows better than to trust it. It's not at all a nice smile, not something that should be so easily displayed on a girl her age. That's life, right? No, Victor says quietly. It isn't, or at least it shouldn't be. But that's not the same thing. Is and shouldn't are entirely different things. He's starting to think Edison isn't going to come back. He can't really blame him. If this is the twisted she's admitting to, how much worse is the twisted she's still hiding? How did things change after his finals?
He was around more in the summer, except for an hour or so in the early afternoon when he walked with his parents in the outer greenhouse. If he came in the mornings, he stayed atop the cliff or in the library, respecting the privacy of my conversations with the other girls in the cave. Danelle had come to replace Lionette as my balance in the more delicate of those conversations, just as she'd started taking the night shift with our new arrivals. There wasn't much to the night shift, given that they were in a drugged sleep, but still, I appreciated being able to get some space. And despite the wings that spread across her cheeks and forehead, Danelle could be trusted as a sensible option. I'd grown used to her double set of red-spotted purples, with their contrasts of deep, rich color and bright pattern breaks. I won't say it suited her any more than the ones on my back suited me, but she'd made them a part of her and learned from the experience. She and Marenka were the last to receive the wings on their faces. After that, they'd talked everyone else out of sucking up to that extent. There were some who came close, but they hadn't crossed the line yet. I took the earliest conversations, and she traded with me once the new girl showed signs of waking. Danelle held back on actually meeting the new girls until they were more or less settled, just like the others with the wings on their faces did. After the first session, I was actually in the room whenever the gardener worked on the new girl's tattoo. She hated needles, but if I read to her and let her squeeze the ever-loving fuck out of my arm, she could lie still for it. It was by her request that I was there, rather than the gardener's, though I think he was pleased by it. As I read aloud from The Count of Monte Cristo, and wondered if that counted as irony, I watched the brilliant ice blue of a spring azure spread across her porcelain skin, broken by occasional veins or fringes of silver white, and one narrow band of midnight blue on the tips of the upper wings. Bliss brought an ice pack with the lunch trays to put on my now perpetually bruised arm. The gardener didn't touch me if Desmond was in the garden, but his son's interest in me roused a corresponding excitement in him. It was no secret among the girls that he liked me best. Honestly, I think they were relieved. But he'd gone from coming to me two or three times a week to damn near every day. He still went to the other girls, of course, but when he was with anyone else, he didn't care if his younger son was in the garden or not. And there was still Avery, but his fangs had been mostly pulled by the destruction of his playroom and the clear pride his father had in Desmond. With his younger brother as a strong example of how their father wanted us treated, it was hard for him to give in to the things he enjoyed. I grew to hate lunch because every single day when Desmond went to share the meal and the early afternoon with his mother, the gardener came to me with a need that made his hands shake. I started taking lunch in my room just so I wouldn't have to suffer the indignity of him coming to the dining room and calling my name across conversations. Even though he knew Desmond hadn't done any more than kiss me, just the thought that he could do more was enough to make the gardener nearly mess his pants. And dear fucking Christ, the possibility that he scoured the security footage hoping to see his son with me was enough to make my brain turn off completely. At least those visits had a specific time limit, because he had to be up at the house by 1:45 to meet his wife for their walk. While the family strolled along the square in the outer greenhouse, I spent the hour with the girl he rechristened Teresa. She was just shy of 17, the daughter of two litigators, and almost never spoke above a whisper. When she did, it was important, Like her asking me to read to her while the gardener inked her wings. She could also be drawn into conversation about music. She played piano, we learned, and wanted to be a professional pianist. She and Ravenna could talk for hours about ballet scores. She paid attention, noticed the undercurrents of any given situation. So she seemed to understand our precarious existence even before I showed her the display cases that first week. For her sake, so she'd have a way to keep herself grounded, I asked the gardener to give her a keyboard. He installed an upright piano in one of the empty rooms, replacing the bed with a beautiful instrument and an entire wall of filing cabinets of sheet music. Except for meals, sleep, and putting up with her visits from the gardener, numerous because she was new, she was in that room, playing the piano until her hands cramped. Desmond met me in the hallway one afternoon, leaning against the garden side wall. His head was tilted to one side as he listened.
"What happens if someone has a breakdown?" he asked quietly.
"In what way?" He nodded in the direction of the doorway.
"You can hear it in the music. She's disintegrating. She's getting choppy, changing the tempos, pounding at the keys. Maybe she doesn't talk, but that doesn't mean she's adapting."
You never really forgot that he was a psych major. "She'll either break or she won't. There's a limit to what I can do to prevent that."
"But what happens if she does?"
"You know what happens. You just don't want to admit it." He'd never asked why Simone hadn't returned. Teresa's arrival was greeted with consternation, followed by an obvious, concerted effort to not think about it too deeply. Desmond paled, but nodded to show he understood. Then he promptly changed the subject. "If you don't look at the bad thing can't see you, right?"
"Liz has some sort of project spread out over the rock. She told me if I sat on any of the clay, she'd shove it up my nose."
"What was she working on?"
"I have no idea. She was still softening the clays."
Summer afternoons were almost unbearably warm in the garden, the heat soaking through the glass. Most girls spent the afternoons in the water or the shade to escape it, or in their rooms, where they could actually feel the cooler air moving through the vents. I wasn't going to disturb Bliss if she was working on something, especially if she was doing it in the hottest part of the garden, so I took Desmond's hand and led him down the hall. It was cooler in the back corner, where the base of the cliff stood directly against the hall glass and blocked the sunlight. I turned into my room, and Desmond immediately began studying the shelf above my bed. He tapped the carousel to make it spin.
"For some reason, I don't really see you as a carousel person," he said,
turning to look at me. "I'm not."
"Then why?"
"Someone else was." He looked back at the carousel and didn't say anything. He couldn't ask for more without hitting things he tried so hard not to think about.
"The gifts we give say as much about us as the gifts we get and keep," he murmured eventually.
He touched the muzzle of the sad little dragon, which now had a tiny pajama-clad teddy bear to keep him company.
"Is it the things that are important or the people?"
"I thought classes were over for the summer." He gave me a sheepish grin.
"Habit."
"Right." My room had changed a bit from that first day. My sheets were a deep rose, the blanket a rich, brilliant purple, with stacks of pillows in a pale fawn brown. My toilet and shower were both concealed by drapes of a matching brown, rose and purple sashes hanging loose against the walls, in case I wanted to clip them back for any reason. There were two short bookcases along one wall with the various books the gardener had given me personally, rather than adding into the library, and the knick-knacks spilled over onto these shelves. The most important, or at least the most personal, staying on the shelf above the bed. Other than the knick-knacks, it was hard to say the room reflected anything about me, as I hadn't chosen anything about it. Even the trinkets were hard to pin down, really. Evita had once painted me a lovely chrysanthemum on a rock, but that showed her sunny personality, not mine. My keeping it just meant that she was important to me. And then there was the thing that made me ever conscious of just how not mine the space was. the blinking red camera light above the door. I sat on the bed, my back against the wall, and watched him bend sideways to read the spines of the books.
How many of these were my father's choice?
Maybe half?
The Brothers Karamazov?
No, that one was mine.
Really?
He grinned at me over his shoulder.
Dense, isn't it?
On the surface. It's fun to discuss. I discussed a lot of books with Zara, but never the classics. That was something Noemi and I had done. Dissecting them, getting into debates that could last for days or even weeks without ever fully being resolved. Rereading Dostoevsky kept Noemi fresh in my mind, in a way that wasn't as painful as directly reminding myself of her and the others in New York. There was a book for each of the girls from the apartment. It was subtler than Nazira's drawings or Bliss's figures, but the same impulse.
Why am I not surprised that you like books with layers?
He finished his perusal and stood next to the bed, hands in his pockets. You can sit on the bed, you know.
This is your space, he said awkwardly. I don't want to presume.
You can sit on the bed, you know. He smiled this time and towed off his shoes, sitting next to me on top of the blankets. We'd kissed a few times since that first one, each one tentative and just a little overwhelming. His father, and to a lesser extent his brother, hovered between us whenever it seemed it might go a little further. And I wasn't sure how I felt about that. Actually, I wasn't sure about much of anything when it came to Desmond. We talked a bit about his friends, about his school, but even that was hard sometimes. I'd been in the garden long enough that the outside world had become somewhat surreal, like a half-believed legend. Eventually, it was time for dinner. Time for him to go back to the house for a while so his mother didn't wonder where he was all the time, and we walked down the hall hand in hand. If I walked him to the entrance, would he send me away before he punched his coat into the lock? I wondered whether that precaution was one his father had drilled into him. If I ran through the door, would he take pity and let me go? Could I get the police back here for the other girls before anything happened to them? If I hadn't been absorbed with the problem of the door, I might have noticed right away, might have recognized how strange the silence was, but it took me a minute to realize we should have been hearing piano music down this entire stretch of hallway. I dropped his hand, not caring that he followed, and ran to the music room, terrified of what I might see. Teresa was alive, and uninjured, but broken. She sat on the piano bench, everything about her posture correct and perfect, and her hands were even on the keys, arched and poised. She looked like she could burst into music at any point. Unless you looked at her face, at the tears that tracked silently down her cheeks, at the absolutely vacant look in her eyes, and understood that whatever made her Teresa wasn't there anymore. Sometimes it happened as quickly as a blink, as a heartbeat, as anything that should have been normal from one to the next. I straddled the bench next to her, one hand against her back. Still staring straight ahead into nothing, she shuddered. "If you can come back, please try," I whispered. "I know it's bad, but after this there's nothing. Worse than nothing."
"Do you think we would make it worse by trying something?"
Desmond asked carefully. "Try what?"
"Here, come off the bench and hold her on the very edge."
He sat down on the far end and carefully scooted over until he had the full range of keys. Teresa didn't fight or struggle when I took her hands away. Desmond took a deep breath and started to play, something soft and gentle and full of pain. Teresa's breath hitched, the only sign that she heard. I closed my eyes as the song continued, my chest tightening with tears I didn't know how to shed. He didn't just play, he effused, and the more he went on, the more Teresa shook in my arms, until finally she burst into heaving sobs and buried her face in my chest. Desmond kept playing, but now the song changed to something light and airy. Not cheerful so much as comforting. Teresa wept, but she was there. Still a little broken, with a few of the essential pieces missing, but responsive. I hugged her, tightly, and for an agonizing moment, I wondered if it would have been kinder to let her stay shattered. To let her die. When we didn't show up at dinner or send for trays, Lorraine told the gardener. We were still in the music room, coaxing Teresa to play something for us when he appeared in the doorway. I noticed him there, but didn't spare him much thought, too intent on the girl who was still shaking like a leaf. Desmond kept his voice soft, made no sudden movement, and finally she put her hands back on the keys, depressing a single note. Desmond pressed a note lower down. Teresa hit another one, which he answered, and gradually the notes became chords and progressions until they were playing a duet I almost recognized. When it was done, she took a deep, slow breath, let it out, then took another.
"You'll get used to it," she whispered almost inaudibly.
I very carefully didn't look at the doorway.
"Yes, you do."
She nodded, used her skirt to wipe off her face and throat, and started another song.
"Thank you."
We listened to her for a couple of songs, until the gardener stepped into the room to get my attention. He crooked his finger, and I bit back a sigh, getting to my feet and joining him in the hallway. Desmond followed. Desmond had saved her, but wouldn't admit to himself what he'd saved her from.
"Lorraine said you skipped dinner," he said quietly.
"Teresa was having a rough patch," I answered. "She was a little more important than dinner."
"Will she be all right?"
"She had to be, or she'd be in glass." I glanced at Desmond, who took my hand with a light squeeze. "I don't think this will be the last rough patch she'll have, but I think this will be the worst. Delayed shock, I guess. Desmond got her playing again, though, so that's a good sign."
"Desmond?"
The gardener smiled, the concern replaced with pride, and he gripped his son's shoulder.
"I'm glad to hear it. Is there anything I can do to help her?"
I bit my lip, and he actually shook his finger at me.
"Maya, the truth now."
"It might be best if you didn't have sex with her for a little while," I sighed. "Spend time with her, fine, but I think sex is going to ask more of her than she can give right now." He blinked at me, somewhat taken aback, but Desmond nodded.
"And keep Avery away from her," he added. "He's always liked breaking things." "How long?"
"Couple of weeks, maybe. Mostly we'll just need to keep an eye on her, see how she's doing." Too aware of his son to give in to what was in his eyes, the gardener pressed a kiss against my forehead.
"You take such good care of them, Maya. Thank you."
I nodded because it seemed safer than talking. He moved past us into the room, and Teresa's song faltered, but gained strength when all he did was pull out a chair from the corner to listen to her play. Desmond and I stood in the hallway for several songs, waiting to see if the choppiness would return. But she sounded like she was at a recital, all smooth grace and memorization. When there didn't seem to be an immediate threat of a new breakdown, he gently tugged on my hand to lead me down the hall.
"Are you hungry?"
"I'm really not." His father would have insisted on my eating anyway, because skipping meals wasn't healthy. His brother would have insisted on my eating, because it would have amused him to watch me force the food past my nausea. But Desmond simply said,
"Okay,"
and led the way to the cave. It was empty, everyone else still in the dining room, and when we were in the center of the damp room, he stopped, turned, and put his arms around me, holding me close.
"He's right about one thing," he said against my hair. "You do take good care of them."
The only reason I knew how was because of the apartment. Because Sophia mothered us all in her slightly warped way. And Lionette. Sophia took care of her girls, but Lionette taught me how to tend butterflies.
"It must be hard to adjust to a place like this, if you've been on the street," he said. "To be safe, but not allowed to leave."
We weren't from the street, and we weren't safe. I just didn't know how to make him understand that, with the girls in glass hidden away. We eventually went to the kitchen, once the panic receded enough that my appetite could make itself known, and as we ate bananas and Nilla wafers, Adara popped her head in and promised to stay with Teresa through the nights. Adara's depression gave her a different perspective than the rest of us, and she'd had to carefully piece herself back together several times before. I kissed her cheek because I didn't have the words to thank her properly. Danelle volunteered her time to the cause as well, inviting the gardener back to her room, like she used to do in the days when she'd earned the wings on her face. I don't think he was blind to the reasons for it, but I think he was touched by it nonetheless, because even if it wasn't for his sake, it was at least for Teresa's. Doing a good thing for another butterfly was the same as doing it for him. Desmond poured a glass of milk and perched the next to me on the counter, passing the glass between us.
If I were to do something really pathetic, do you think you could pretend to like it to humor my ego?
I looked at him warily. I'd love to be supportive and say yes, but I can't promise that without knowing what it is. He drained half the glass in one gulp.
Come on, I'll show you.
Is it still being supportive if I say I'm scared but will come along anyway?
It'll do.
He lifted me off the counter and took my hand as we walked out of the kitchen and into the garden. It was still a little bit light out, twilight painting across the sky, and I watched the colors change. He ducked us behind the waterfall into the cave, then let go of my hand.
Wait here.
He came back less than a minute later.
Close your eyes.
When Desmond told me to do something, more to the point when I actually did it, I didn't feel like I was merely obeying. I obeyed the gardener, I obeyed Avery. Desmond was more careful about what he asked me to do. The waterfall drowned out the sound of his movements, but after a moment I heard music. Music I actually recognized. Sway was Sophia's favorite song, the one she danced to with her girls at the end of every visit, and she couldn't hear the last notes without crying. Desmond took my hands, placed one of them on his hip, and stepped in close.
Open your eyes.
An iPod and speaker sat on a safely dry portion of the floor near the hallway. He smiled at me, a little bit nervously, and gave a lopsided shrug.
Dance with me?
I don't. I took a deep breath, and somehow his nervous smile was on my lips. I don't know how to dance.
That's okay, all I can do is waltz.
You can waltz?
Mother's charity functions.
Ah. He pulled me even closer, until my cheek rested against his shoulder, and he swayed us back and forth. He held our joined hands against his chest, his other hand sliding to the small of my back. Softly, almost inaudibly at first, he started singing along. I let him lead, burying my face in his shoulder to hide whatever my face was showing. There's this moment when you know that suddenly everything's changed. Most people have that moment many times in their lives. I had it when I was 3, and I realized my dad wasn't like the rest of his family. I had it when I was 6, and I sat on the fucking carousel as everyone walked away. I had it when I had to take a taxi to my gran's, when my gran died, when Noemi poured me that first drink at the apartment. I had it when I woke up in the garden, when I got a new name that was supposed to eradicate everything I had been before. And now, in the arms of this strange, unaccountable boy, I knew that even if nothing else changed, everything was different. Maybe I could change him, convince or trick or manipulate him into contributing to the freedom I wanted for all of us. But it wouldn't be without a price. Yes? I could feel his grin against my temple.
Yes?
Right now I could hate you a little. He didn't stop dancing, but the smile faded.
Why?
Because this is royally fucked up. I took a slow, deep breath, thought about what to say next. And because this is going to break my heart.
Does that mean you love me too?
My mother taught me to make sure the man always says it first. He leaned back a little, just enough to see my face.
Did she really?
Yes. I don't think he could tell if I was serious or not. The song ended, rolling over to something I should probably have recognized, and he put some space between us.
Who am I saying it to? Because you may answer to Maya, but it's not who you are.
I shook my head. I can't think like that. Not when I don't have any chance to be that person again. His face fell, but honestly, what did he expect? Then he got down on one knee, holding both my hands, and smiled up at me.
I love you, Maya, and I swear I will never hurt you.
I believed part of that. I didn't want to feel guilty for it. But I did. So I perched on his knee and kissed him. And he got so involved with kissing me back that he overbalanced and we both fell onto the damp stone. He laughed and kept kissing me and kissing me, and I knew I could never believe the rest of it. Desmond wasn't good, no matter how much he wanted to be. And better than his family just wasn't enough. Every day he helped keep us here, he hurt me.
I didn't recite Poe that time, in case you were wondering. No, for that I'm sure you were paying full attention, Victor agrees dryly. So, were you serious?
What, me and Des?
Well, yes, but more specifically, what you said about your mother.
Actually, yes.
He ponders that for a moment, tries to make sense of it. He fails.
Still want to find out who I am and where I came from?
Yes.
Why?
He sighs and shakes his head. Because I can't put a fake person on the stand.
I'm not a fake person. I'm carefully and genuinely handcrafted.
He shouldn't laugh. He really shouldn't laugh. But he does. And then he can't stop. And he's leaning against the table, trying to at least muffle the sound. When he finally looks up, she's smiling at him, a real one this time. And he answers it gratefully.
The real world intrudes, doesn't it?
She asks gently, and his laughter fades. Keeping me honest?
It hurts you to ask, and it hurts you to listen, even when so much of it you've heard before. I like you, Special Agent Victor Hanoverian. Your girls are lucky to have you. The story's almost over anyway. Then it can't hurt for a little while.
The end of the summer brought a shift in the garden. Desmond had spent so much time with us, he'd become a fixture. And even though I was the only one he touched, I wasn't the only one who got to know him. Teresa talked to him more than she talked to me, because music crossed the boundaries of our cage and made her forget. Even if just for a while. Even Bliss seemed to like Desmond, though I wouldn't stake a wager on how much of that was for my sake. Gradually, the girls felt comfortable with him in a way they never would with his father and brother, because he was never going to ask anything of them. Most of them had given up hope of ever being rescued, so there wasn't even much bitterness as to why he didn't report anything. And the gardener was over the moon. The very first time we talked about Des, he'd said his mother's very proud of him. I had thought that meant that he wasn't, but I knew better now. He was always proud of Desmond, but when faced with a girl who knew only Avery, he had to acknowledge the son who openly shared the same fascination with keeping an unwilling harem. Now that Desmond was part of the garden, his father's happiness was complete. Teresa's breakdown was the only one that summer. There were no accidents, no 21st birthdays. Nothing to force us to remember that we couldn't have just a little bit of fun. Well, except for the gardener and Avery still raping at will, that put a damper on things. But the gardener shifted how he treated me. After Desmond and I had sex, the gardener didn't touch me that way anymore. He treated me like a, well, like a house mother, I guess, or a daughter. I wasn't like Lorraine, I wasn't being exiled from his affection, but somehow he decided that I was Desmond's now. With Avery, he shared, with Desmond, he gave. Fucked up, no? But just for a while, I was willing to accept that without question. If I was going to have any hope of moving Desmond, it couldn't just be infatuation. I needed him to truly love me, to be willing to fight for me. And that wasn't going to happen if he was still sharing me with his father and brother. The gardener even disabled the camera in my room, because Des asked him to. said it made him self-conscious to think that his father was watching him have sex, and couldn't he be trusted not to hurt me when he loved me so dearly? Okay, I'm sure the conversation was a bit more graceful and manly than that, but Liss had the girls in stitches with her version of it. Desmond was still his father's son, though. Whenever I tried to walk into the door, he'd politely but firmly send me away, so I couldn't see him put in his code.
"It would destroy my mother," he said when I finally mentioned it.
Taking direct action against his father would be complicated, I got that, but why not give us the chance to rescue ourselves?
"My family's name, our reputation, our company? I can't be the one to destroy that."
"Because a name means more than a life. Men all our lives." The weekend before the fall semester started, we had a concert in the garden. Desmond brought in better speakers and set them up on the cliff, and just for the evening, the gardener gave us all bright colors and treats, and fuck, it was pathetic how happy we were that evening. We were still captives, we still had death sitting on our shoulders and counting down to our 21st birthdays, but that night was magical anyway. Everyone laughed and danced and sang, no matter how badly, and the gardener and Desmond danced with us. Avery sat off to one side and sulked because the whole thing had been Desmond's idea. After we cleaned everything up, and the girls split off into the rooms for the night, Des brought the smallest speaker back to my room, and we danced, swaying in place as we kissed. Intimacy with Des wasn't real, any more than with his father, but he didn't realize that. I'd never said it, but he thought I loved him, too. He thought this was happiness, that this was somehow healthy and stable, the kind of thing you build a life around. He either missed or glossed over my frequent reminders that caged things have shorter lives. Des wanted so badly to be good, to do good. But our circumstances hadn't changed, nor were they likely to. When we finally tumbled onto the bed, I was almost dizzy from his kisses, and he couldn't stop laughing. His hands were everywhere, and he followed them with his mouth, his laughter tickling my skin. Sex with Des wasn't intimacy, but it was fun. He drove me crazy with his teasing, until I finally rolled us over and pinned him, biting my lip as I sank down onto him. He groaned and rolled his hips, then laughed when a really inappropriate song started playing. When I slapped his stomach, he sat up to kiss me dizzy again, then pushed me onto my back at the foot of the bed. Which is when I saw Avery, standing in the doorway and scowling as he jacked himself off. I yelped. Not proud of that. And Desmond looked up to see what had alarmed me.
"Avery, get out!"
"I have as much right to her as you do," Avery growled.
"Get out!"
There was a small part of me that was about to die laughing. Fortunately, that part was mostly squashed in the general sense of fury and mortification. I thought about reaching for a blanket, but Avery had seen all of me before, and Desmond? Well, his bits weren't exactly showing at the moment. I closed my eyes as they argued over my head, because I didn't want to know if Avery still had himself in hand while he fought with his brother. And because the laughter was threatening to win. Enter the gardener, because, of course.
"Just what the hell is going on? Avery, put that away."
I opened my eyes to see Avery fastening his pants and the gardener trying to button his shirt. "Oh, look, the whole family, except for Eleanor." Swearing under his breath, Desmond pulled away from me and handed me my dress before reaching for his pants. Sometimes it's the little things.
"Would you care to explain why your argument is carrying over the entire garden?" the gardener demanded, his voice low and dangerous.
The brothers started talking over each other, but their father cut them off with a sharp gesture.
"Maya?"
"Des and I were having sex, and Avery decided to invite himself to the party."
He was standing in the door and jacking it. After a wince at my crudeness, the gardener stared at his firstborn, the anger slowly joined by an appalled horror.
"What were you thinking?"
"Why does he get to have her? He's never helped you bring anyone in, he's never gone out with you to find them, but you give her to him like a fucking bride and I'm not even allowed to touch her?"
It took a minute for the gardener to find his voice.
"Maya, would you please excuse us?"
"Of course," I answered politely, because courtesy is as much a bitch as disdain.
Would you like me to leave?
Not at all. This is your room. Desmond, join us, please. Avery, come.
I stayed on the bed until I couldn't.